Like our friends at Montpelier, we've never shied away from the issue of slavery on this show. In fact, we've said repeatedly that it was our original constitutional sin, that there's a fundamental contradiction between a country founded on the principle that all men are created equal and then an institution that denies equality and freedom to a vast segment of society. We generally tend to think of the Civil War as being the defining moment in the abolition of slavery, and it was. But that doesn't mean that people weren't trying to abolish it for a long time beforehand. In fact, for many decades beforehand, people were active in this regard. This week, Nick Wood, who's a fellow at Yale University, is going to tell us about the early abolitionists, some of the first people to raise their voices against this evil institution. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional, and this week it's about early abolitionists.
Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
What do you know about the history of abolitionism in the United States, the abolition of slavery? Well, if you've paid any attention to it at all, you probably think of one particular fellow. You think of William Lloyd Garrison. You think of his abolitionist newspaper, The Liberator. And you think about the great climax of the abolitionist movement of the 1850s leading up to the Civil War. And that's appropriate. That's a very important era of history to study. But my guest today, Nick Wood, who's a postdoc fellow at Yale University, studies an earlier history, an era that people actually will call prior or before William Lloyd Garrison, the history of early abolitionism. And it turns out there have been a lot of people who have been opposed to slavery for a long time before the Civil War, notably one group you've heard of, the Quakers, but other people as well, and their voices deserve to be heard. So I was very pleased recently when I caught up with Nick Wood at Montpelier, where he was teaching a seminar on this subject, and here's our fascinating discussion.
My name's Nicholas Wood. I'm a historian of slavery and abolition. I got my PhD here, nearby in Charlottesville at the University of Virginia. And now I'm the Cassius Marcellus Clay Postdoctoral Associate in Early American History at Yale University.
I know
it's
I've
a very
that,
long
please.
Table or title.
My gosh, PhD at UVA, which is extremely cool.
Yep, thank you.
And now postdoc at Yale.
Yep.
So you're kind of a slouch.
Yep. And you're
on your way. You're at the very beginning of a fantastic academic career, I'm sure.
And you may have heard of Cassius Clay, but this is probably not the one you're thinking of. It's not the boxer. This is the guy the boxer was named after,
right?
Who was a Kentucky slaveholder in the mid-19th century who turned against slavery, freed his slaves, became an abolitionist, editor of a newspaper, and had to physically fight off a number of pro-slavery mobs and would-be assassins, and eventually served in the Abraham Lincoln's administration as ambassador of Russia.
What?
So a really interesting guy, and he went to Yale, and so they now have this postdoc in his honor.
And you have it.
I do.
This is absolutely fantastic. As we were sitting down here, you told me something very nice about your time when you were in Charlottesville.
Yeah. My wife especially, and me too, are fans of your show. My wife was a civics teacher at Fluvanna County, so she loves anything related to the Constitution. And we actually met working at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia.
Wow.
So we've always been interested in these subjects and enjoyed the show while we were here.
Well, I'm absolutely honored by that. And what's your wife's name?
Allison Wood.
Allison.
Yep, formerly of Fluvanna County High School.
Hello, Allison. And I understand congratulations are in order for you and Allison as well?
Yes, we have a baby named Felix who's about to turn 9 months old this weekend.
And so,
on the 8th.
And you've had 6 hours of sleep in the last 7 days then?
Yeah, total. About that.
Well, congratulations.
Yep, thank you.
Those are all wonderful accomplishments. You are out there just accomplishing all sorts of things, both academically and biologically and romantically. So well done on all fronts.
Yeah, thank you.
And I hope that you and your wife do get some sleep while you're here at lovely Montpelier.
We're trying.
In fact, you are here at Montpelier. We're here
yes.
in the Potter Studios. And I have the pleasure and the good timing to be out here while you are talking on, you're teaching a seminar.
Yes.
And on the subject of abolition and slavery, right?
Yep. Yeah, slavery in the Constitution.
Well, start at the beginning. Tell us how you got interested in this sort of thing, and then we'll talk about what you're going to talk about here.
Really, if you want the kind of the long history.
Sure, why not? We got time.
Began when I was an undergraduate at Rutgers University, and wasn't sure if I was going to be a history major or an English major, and I was choosing my class schedule, as many undergraduates do, based largely on what was a convenient time. So I just randomly signed up.
It's so funny to hear you say that. I was talking to somebody about summer classes recently, and I had like this parade of students coming by and saying, when is your class being offered? And I would say, 9 o'clock. Oh, thanks.
Yeah. That's all they need to know.
But it's a good class. We were looking for afternoon classes, ideally that were neither Monday or Friday.
Yep.
So you were just like my students.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
And so I randomly took a class called Slavery in World History and by Christopher Brown, now at Columbia, but at Rutgers at the time. And it was just a fabulous class and just really captured my interest, all the kind of the really big kind of complex moral questions about slavery, why people tolerated slavery, kind of why it lasted so long, the different forms of resistance, the different motives for white abolitionism. And that was the class that kind of determined that I would definitely be a history major, and took a while, but ultimately led me back to graduate school to study the topic in more detail. And that's what I've been doing.
I sense that you are part of a very significant movement in the last couple of decades that's focused upon the history of slavery. I mean, I'm not a historian, but it hardly seems like a week or a month goes by that I don't read about some new study or some new book that's coming out on this. So this is fertile ground, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, really beginning with the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s, that kind of inspired a whole new level of attention, and it's just been growing since then. So it really has been kind of the most dynamic field within the realm of history, other than, of course, like things that post-World War II things that people are writing about. But in terms of the past, the far past, slavery and abolitionism are one of the kind of the most important fields that people are doing new work on still.
Yeah, and it's an area that I think really deserves a lot of attention. It's an uncomfortable subject.
Yeah.
I recall when I was a child growing up, and I'm significantly older than you are, but when I was growing up in the 60s and the 70s, slavery was just sort of taboo. I mean, you would acknowledge it, perhaps, if you were on going to a historic site that involved slavery. They'd mention it very briefly, if at all, and then you talk about the China, or you would talk about the architecture, or you would talk about anything else but slavery.
Yeah.
And a lot of historic sites would sort of ignore it, even places like right here where we are, places like Montpelier. The Montpelier itself has, from its inception, acknowledged slavery and has really been a leader in that regard, especially lately. Monticello, which has been around a lot longer as a historic site, I can attest has gone through an evolution.
Yeah.
Because now they're very much at the forefront.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, fact, Montpelier and Monticello work a lot together and not in the same lines. But I recall going to Monticello 15, 20 years ago. And I happened to be there with an exchange student who was staying with me. Her name was Tembi. She was from Zimbabwe.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a sub-Saharan black African. And she was sort of taken aback by how blithely it was treated. And some of the comments that were made, especially by some of the tourists, Thomas Jefferson was a good master.
Yeah.
You know, sort of almost an apologetic to the extent of it. So I'm sorry, I'm going on too long. My point is that this is an important area that is very current in terms of the historiography that's being done right now, right?
Yeah.
And so you're part of it. You're part of the new wave.
Yep. But just speaking of historic houses, though, just reminds me, my wife and I a few years ago visited President Polk's house in Tennessee.
James K. Polk.
Yep. And they didn't mention slavery at all. So at the end, my wife asked about him and slavery. And the tour guide and elderly woman kind of just quickly mentioned, he had about five house slaves and he freed them all. And then kind of she mumbled under her breath, but then there was another slave plantation with several hundred slaves that were sold off. Almost didn't want us to hear that part. And the whole tour itself just completely ignored the issue, just referred to maybe servants being around.
Right. Yep. So there's been, I hesitate to use the word whitewashing. I don't mean that in a racial sense, but it's sort of a cover-up, a tacit cover-up for many, many years. And so this is an extraordinarily important part of American history. Yeah. Certainly it is the constitutional issue, certainly of the first half of our national existence,
yeah,
with reverberations down to the present day. So good for you. Glad you're doing
Thank
it.
You.
Now, let's talk about your work. Tell us, you really focus upon early abolitionists, don't you?
I mean,
not so much Civil War era, but like even pre-revolutionary, right?
Yeah.
So tell us about that.
So the working title of my book is Before Garrison, Anti-Slavery and Politics in the New Nation. And the Before Garrison part is one of those terms that any specialist knows immediately what I'm talking about, but regular listeners won't. So that's referring to William Lloyd Garrison, who's kind of like the big famous white abolitionist beginning in the 1830s. He's the publisher of the Liberator newspaper in Boston, which kind of declares that it's going to be vocal against slavery and no quarter for slaveholders. And eventually he embraces disunion and is one of the kind of the really radical abolitionists.
So there's before Garrison and after Garrison.
Yeah. And so I'm looking at
AG. Okay.
Yeah. I'm looking at the period before him, which, again, traditionally didn't get as much attention, especially beginning in the 90s. It's been getting more and more, but still it's much less studied than the latter period. And so I'm looking kind of initially I was beginning with the American Revolution when I was writing my dissertation at UVA. But then I kept finding out that Quakers, I mean, most people have a sense that Quakers were kind of at the forefront of early anti-slavery, but I kept finding out they were more and more important than even I was led to believe by the existing literature, and that they turned against slavery kind of earlier and earlier. And ultimately, I concluded it was the French and Indian War beginning in 1754. That was kind of the key moment for the Quakers. And so the kind of their And many – so they turned against slavery beginning in the 1750s as
Can
a kind of a corporate
here?
Group.
But
sure.
Let's start at the very beginning.
Okay.
Just so we're all oriented. Mm. When did the first slave ships arrive? When did the first slaves from Africa arrive here? 1600s, early 1600s,
yeah.
Right?
So, I mean, in what is now the United States, 1619 in Virginia, about 20-odd Negroes, I think, was the description of the vessel that arrived.
And for a long time, now you know more about this, so I'm just going to recite what I think I know, and you tell me if I'm wrong. For a long time, African slaves worked alongside indentured servants who were mostly European extraction.
Yeah.
So there was sort of a dual system of slavery and semi-slavery, and maybe even some commonalities, because my understanding is that some African slaves were treated like indentured servants early on.
Yeah.
And were actually granted freedom. And there's this whole long history of early slavery. The slaves arrive in early 1600s. I mean, for heaven's sake, I mean, we didn't even have Europeans here in a permanent settlement until 1607.
Yeah,
in Jamestown. So this was 12 years later.
Mm-hmm.
So very
early. Yeah, very early.
At the same time they were there, there were what we might call semi-slaves or indentured servants is the actual term, and these were mostly of European extraction.
Yes.
The two groups were, to some extent, working side by side. They sort of shared some attributes with each other.
Yeah. I mean,
there were some African slaves who actually were eventually freed, like indentured servants.
Yep.
But gradually, indentured servitude fell by the wayside. There
yeah.
was that whole big issue with Bacon's Rebellion in 1676. And so African slavery became the preferred method.
Yeah.
And then gradually, there was sort of a tightening up of slavery, and there were more and more restrictions put on it until it became racial, until it became permanent
yep.
and generational. Is that a fair statement about the early history of slavery?
Yeah, yeah. And general historians emphasize that kind of the 17th century is this period of more fluidity along kind of racial lines where some people use the term Atlantic Creoles for these kind of educated Africans that often some of them came to the Americas as free people, others gained their freedom after being enslaved for a period, and some of them actually became wealthy landowners. Some even became slaveholders themselves.
And what we would commonly call free black people.
Yeah.
There's a whole history of free black people living in the United States, even in the South.
Yeah. It's more
sort of
common in the Caribbean,
uh-huh.
But there was some of that in places like Virginia as well.
Right. And then, of course, it was only later, as slavery became more and more controversial and more entrenched, that there was more and more pressure on these free black people, many of whom then left the South. And so they were not as evident in the era post-Garrison that most people are more familiar with. That's a whole history there to be mined. You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is Nick Wood, who is a postdoc associate in early American history at Yale University, and he specializes in the history of slavery and abolition. And we're having a really remarkable discussion. I'm learning so much about the history of abolition and the history of the institution of slavery, which was a lot more complex than you might think. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and we'll come back and speak some more with Nick Wood. Stick around. Here I am back in the Potter Family Studios at the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier, and I'm in here with the quiz guy, Doug Smith, and I've just learned something. Is it true, Doug, the one time you killed a man?
We don't talk about it.
Oh, we don't talk. Okay.
We don't talk about that.
Maybe after we're off the air, can you? No? No? Okay. Well, then maybe it's true. I don't know. That's kind of making me nervous here today. Do we have anybody on the line? Please, someone needs to keep me company. I'm with a dangerous man here.
I think we've got a caller.
Do we have a caller?
Caller, what is your name?
Name is Seth Baker.
Seth Baker. What a pleasure to hear from you, Seth. Where are you from?
Clintwood, Virginia.
Clintwood, Virginia. I think I've been through Clintwood, Virginia. That's a beautiful area. It's in Southwest Virginia, isn't it?
That's correct.
It's all right, Seth. Are you ready for a quiz?
I'm ready.
Okay, Doug, have at him.
Clintwood. That's one I haven't been to yet.
Clintwood. I don't think it's huge. How big is Clintwood, Seth?
Probably about 2,000 people.
Oh, okay.
Well, that's pretty big for Southwest Virginia.
That's not bad. All right.
Okay.
Well, Seth, here it comes. I'm going to read you a question. I'm going to give you four choices. Are you about ready?
I'm ready.
All right, here we go. Which branch of the military does the Constitution allow to be funded for more than 2 years at a time?
Oh, man.
Which branch of the military does the Constitution allow to be funded for more than 2 years at a time? Is it A, the Army, B, the Navy, C, the Air Force, or D, the Marines?
This is a hard question.
Quite possibly the hardest question in the history
of the quiz.
Of your weekly constitutional quiz.
I think it might be the hardest one. On the other hand, I'm confident, Seth, that if you think about those answer choices, you'll be able to knock out at least one or two of them. So what are your thoughts?
I'm going to go with the Navy.
Are you going to go straight to the Navy?
Just straight to the Navy.
Why are you going straight to the Navy?
At that time, I'm thinking our forefathers thought that the Navy was probably the most important branch possibility of the military, fighting England, the Spaniards. So they need the importance of seeing that and make sure they had money. So I'm going to put all in on the Navy.
I'm thinking it has to be the Air Force, Seth. Don't you think so? I mean, back in 1787, it took a long time to build a plane.
And I could see that being a close second or third.
we could probably knock that one out, right?
Knock out the Army
and the Navy and the Marines were all around from at the very beginning. So if the Army and the Navy and Marines, you're going straight to the Navy and you don't want
to
go...
Straight to the Navy.
So. You know, you don't apply for the Marines. You earn
a
spot in the Marines. Yeah. Hooyah.
Well, Doug, is Seth correct?
Seth is absolutely correct.
Yeah, Seth, congratulations. That's marvelous. Is his reasoning correct simply because it was the most important branch?
No, not at all.
Okay.
But it was close.
I mean,
I think you have to give Seth the benefit of the doubt here.
Uh-huh.
So Article 1, Section 8 very clearly lays out around budgeting that you will not budget for the Army for longer than 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
But for the Navy, there's not such a stipulation.
Mm-hmm.
And the intention around that was really because you didn't want a large multi-year funded entity on land.
Mm-hmm.
The Navy is much less of a threat towards the sovereignty of the people from military rule.
I think that has to be part of the rationale. I've never researched this, and in fact, I was guessing that it was the Navy. I didn't really remember from the text of Article 1, Section 8. But I think you're probably right, Doug, is that there was such a reluctance to have a standing army that they would want to have a very short leash on it and be able to defund it very quickly. Indeed, there were a huge debates at the Constitutional Convention about the standing army, and there are a couple of anecdotes that are somewhat apocryphal that I will from time to time tell people. One of them is not suitable for the radio. The other one is, though, the story goes that Elbridge Gerry, who was very much opposed to standing armies, at one time proposed a compromise. It was along the lines of, okay, I'll let you have a standing army, but we have to limit it to 2,500 men. Now, supposedly, George Washington, who said almost nothing at the convention, said, okay, he could agree to that as long as the Constitution also limited the size of any invading army to only 2,500. And I don't think he actually said it, but I think that in some sense that captures the idea. Washington was a very practical man, and he was very much in favor of a standing army because he'd, of course, been in charge of the army, and he saw the ravages that the Redcoats had wrought upon us. And so he wanted to be able to defend the nation, and I think so that was probably consistent with his position, though I don't think he actually said it. I could see that. I was thinking that there had to be another rationale, and that is that it takes a long time to build a ship.
To build a boat.
Right. You can't, you don't want to half a boat, and you don't want to have to stop. So I would that might have been part of the rationale as well. Maybe one day we'll figure it out. But Seth, congratulations. You've earned not only a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier, but also a T-shirt. So please find us on Facebook. Well, actually, you did. You volunteered for this on Facebook. So send us another Facebook message and give us your mailing address and your T-shirt size, and we will have your constitution and your T-shirt in the snail mail to you very soon.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Well, we appreciate you, Seth. And we appreciate that very interesting question, Doug.
Hey, you bet. It's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. In case you're just joining us, I'll mention that Nick Wood is my guest this week. He's the Cassius Marcellus Clay Postdoctoral Associate in Early American History at Yale University. And what Nick specializes in is the history of slavery and specifically of abolitionism. And it turns out that there's a lot of stuff there that most of us don't even think about. If you think about slavery, you think, oh, bad. It's a bad institution. And maybe you've got some images that you picked up along the way, maybe from films like Gone with the Wind or Song of the South, if you're of a certain age. That was, A, inaccurate for the most part. And B, to the extent it even represented something accurately, it was one particular era, typically right before the Civil War. But slavery was around for a long time. In fact, slaves were first brought over to this continent in 1619. So think about that. For over 100 years before the Civil War, 200 years before the Civil War, there were slaves all throughout the United States. And the institution of slavery changed over time. Before the break, we were talking about how the issue of free black people and whether they could be freed at all and what would happen to them after they were freed became a big issue as early as 1700. And soon thereafter, the colonies started cracking down on the institution.
Beginning in the 1720s, that's when kind of the slave codes, the colonial laws regulating slavery, really crack down on manumissions and make it almost
fancy
impossible.
Word for freeing slaves.
Yeah, make it almost impossible for a slaveholder to free his slaves, even if he wants to. Like in Virginia, for example, you can only free a slave for meritorious service as determined by the legislature or a county court. So that would be like if a slave reports on other slaves that are conspiring to rise in rebellion, that informant slave could get permission from the court or the legislature to be freed. But you couldn't just free a slave because they were faithful to you and you wanted to reward them, or because you had moral qualms about slavery. Maybe you had inherited them from your parents but you think it's wrong. You weren't allowed to free them. And even if you got that permission, the free black person then had to leave the province within 6 months or be re-enslaved. And when they re-enslave them, it's kind of ironic, they often use the proceeds of that to fund kind of the local church parish to fund poor relief. So kind of giving money from the sale of human beings to kind of humanitarian causes.
So if you were freed, or if you came here as a free black, eventually it got to the point where the institution is becoming more and more coercive, and if you want to stay free, you just better get the heck out of Dodge.
Yeah.
And in fact, from the position of the slave-owning class, which was basically in charge, free black people were a problem. They mm-hmm. were a problem because they were an example that to the slaves,
yeah.
that it was possible to be both black and free, and slave owners didn't want that example.
Yeah.
And certainly didn't want a place for their slaves to run away to.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually that whole group of people was essentially run out of town, out of the South.
Yeah, we do find like things really vary from locality to locality.
Right.
The kind of the formal laws becoming more and more strict. But in certain localities where there's just a level of trust among people, like they might just know that this family of free black people, they're not a threat to anyone. We've known them for years. Maybe we've known kind of maybe our families have known each other for generations. They'll tolerate that free black family. And even though legally they're not allowed to live here, nobody's going to report them. Nobody's going to enforce them. So there's
Did that continue all the way through the Civil War? I mean, were there literally free black families
yeah.
living in the South right through the Civil War?
Yeah.
See, I had the impression that they pretty much all left by the
no,
time.
No, no. I mean, there's always the threat of expulsion. But places like Charlottesville actually had some significant numbers of free black people. And some of them aren't even legally free. They're just allowed to live as free people, in which case that if anybody did challenge it, their master could say, well, oh, no, actually, I still technically own them, so you can't expel them. And so that's also one of the things that Quakers would do when they did turn against slavery.
Mm-hmm.
If they weren't allowed to free their slaves, they would simply allow them to kind of live more or less as free people while technically maintaining kind of property rights over them.
So lots of nuance here. Lots of variation
yeah, really
from
complicated.
Place to place. Okay. That's kind of the, at least we're acknowledging the complexity and the nuance of the
yeah.
early stages of slavery. And as it developed as an institution. But then to go back to your focus, so an abolitionist movement, you say, really came to fruition as late, it took over 100
yeah.
years
yeah.
So, for
I mean,
there to be an abolitionist movement.
That, yeah.
That's striking to me.
Yeah, I mean, people were, of course, criticizing slavery, and of course, black people are resisting from the very beginning
right.
on the African coast, on the Middle Passage and the slave ships, and then once they arrive. But the first kind of concerted efforts doesn't really crystallize until the mid-18th century. There are some 17th century anti-slavery protests, again, especially from Quakers, the most famous being the 1688 Germantown protest from some Philadelphia Quakers.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, even that was just signed, I believe, by four Quakers and the kind of the monthly meeting, which is kind of like the Quaker, kind of their larger church, they considered it, referred it up to kind of the yearly meeting of Quakers, and they discussed it, but they don't do anything. In 1696, Quakers, there's again some more anti-slavery protests by individual Quakers, and kind of as a collective group, they say that the slave trade is wrong and that Quakers shouldn't be involved in it, but there's no enforcement of that. There's no sanctions against anybody that breaks it. And it's
interesting. Dolly Madison was from a Quaker family.
Yeah.
Slave-holding family.
Mm-hmm.
Her father held slaves for a while, eventually decided it was immoral, freed them, and then lived a life of penury. I mean, he paid
yeah.
a real price economically for it. So there were both legal constraints on manumission.
Yeah.
And there was just the practical economic concern that most of your wealth is tied up in slaves.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the right thing to do. But it came at a very high price.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a lot of Quakers who are opposed to this. It takes a while for this to crystallize. Finally, we get to the 1750s, and that's the birth, if you will, of the early anti-slavery movement. So please continue.
Sure. So they're beginning the 1740s as a kind of reformation of Quakerism. They'd been concerned about backsliding, like kind of most religious groups that come over, the Puritans are concerned about backsliding. And then there's kind of this push to kind of be more religious and eradicate sin. And so a lot of people are saying slavery's this big sin we need to deal with. And in 1754, the kind of the Philadelphia Yearly Meeting, which again is kind of the big Quaker organization in America, begins publishing some anti-slavery writings by Anthony Benezet and John Woolman. And then with the outbreak of the French and Indian War, or known as the Seven Years' War in Europe, also in 1754, that kind of these anti-slavery reformers who had just been beginning to get a little influence, they say, look, this war is divine retribution for the sins of the British Empire, especially slavery. And this really helps them persuade other Quakers, and kind of they really use this violent language of divine retribution. God is kind of raining down terror upon us. We deserve all the sufferings. There's lots of fighting with the Native Americans, very bloody, savage warfare in the frontier. And they're saying all this is justly deserved punishment for our complicity in slavery. Mm. And so in 1758, that's when the Quakers, the Philadelphia Yearly Meeting, which sets policy for kind of the mid-Atlantic, including parts of northern Virginia, they finally say if you were engaged in slave trading, you'll be expelled, you'll be disowned from being a Quaker. And they encourage all Quakers who own slaves to educate them and set them at liberty. And they say if you don't do this, you can't hold any position of authority within the Society of Friends, within Quakers. Mm-hmm. But they don't formally disown them yet. They eventually adopt that policy in 1776, which is mostly coincidental timing. People often point to it as kind of emphasizing, oh, it's the same year as the Declaration of Independence. This kind of shows this larger turn against slavery. But the Quakers had really been moving in that direction from the French and Indian War more than they're not so much inspired by the Revolution. Many Quakers, in fact, most Quakers were very kind of reluctant supporters, if not opponents of the American Revolution.
Hmm. And they themselves were often rather pacifistic.
Yeah.
So even as they're using this violent rhetoric of divine mm-hmm. retribution, they themselves were also not particularly interested yeah. in serving in the revolutionary cause.
Yeah, yeah, and their pacifism really informs their anti-slavery too, as does just kind of the recognition of black resistance. And mm-hmm. going back to 1696, in some of those early Quaker protests, they said, like, what if these slaves rise and revolt? We as pacifists, what can we do? We can't morally suppress rebellion. So we shouldn't put ourselves in a situation where we might have to do something that'll break our pacifistic principles.
That's another thing running through all of this. And there were slave rebellions, the most famous, of course, being Nat Turner's rebellion, which was yep. somewhat later, early 19th century, if I recall.
1830.
Yeah, 1830, right. But there's always a fear of that. Mm-hmm. And in some states, notably South Carolina, I think that the slave population might have been actually in a majority.
Yeah.
Or very close to it. You know, it was roughly 50-50. So you're living sort of on a time bomb. Mm-hmm. If you're a slave owner and you have half a brain, you look around and you think to yourself, these people don't like this.
Yeah.
They don't want to be slaves, and there are more of them than there are of us, or maybe locally on a given plantation there are more slaves.
Yeah.
This is a problem. I was really struck some years ago when I went to John Marshall's house in Richmond.
Mm-hmm.
We did a whole episode on it. It was fascinating. And they made a point of saying that there was one trusted slave who was the house slave, and that every night his job was to lock and bar the doors.
Yeah.
Because there was always that fear that the people right there that you saw and worked with every day, or who worked for mm-hmm. you every day, would come in some evening and slit your family's throat.
Yeah.
And that's, of course, what happened in Nat Turner's rebellion to some extent. And,
yep.
Golly. Yeah, so there are all sorts of reasons to be an abolitionist. There's
yeah.
the moral reason, and then there's the reason of, you know, golly. This is not a good situation to be
yeah.
in. Okay. All right. So, and is it exclusively Quakers?
Not exclusively. And again, when we talk about the variety of white people, blacks are basically uniformly opposed to this.
Of course.
But yeah, I mean, among white people, Quakers are definitely the dominant group. Most outspoken anti-slavery writers are Quakers. Doesn't mean that all Quakers are abolitionist. A lot of them were quite slow. They resisted these policies. Many do get disowned. With the American Revolution, you do get more and more non-Quakers embracing this cause, partly in this kind of effort to some are sincerely inspired by this new rhetoric of natural rights that the Patriots used so much during the Revolution.
All men are created equal
yeah.
comes to mind.
Yeah. Yep. But others are just kind of more practical about it. They don't want to be charged with hypocrisy. They're trying to get French and European support and sympathy, so they don't want to appear like hypocrites talking about their own liberty while enslaving other people. So they kind of have kind of self-interested reasons to appear consistent on this issue. And so you see a lot of patriots kind of injecting little kind of anti-slavery sentiments into their writings, though in general they don't do a whole lot. It's often kind of when they do take action, it's generally in response to kind of the actual resistance by slaves or lobbying by Quaker abolitionists. I mean, there are some sincere non-Quakers. Benjamin Rush of Philadelphia, the doctor who signed the Declaration of Independence. He's actually encouraged by Anthony Benezet, though, one of those Quakers I mentioned. So he publishes two anti-slavery pamphlets in 1773. One of them, the first one, provokes a kind of a pro-slavery response. So then he issues a second edition responding to that.
Did they have any actual success? I mean, did you actually start getting abolition in any of the colonies before the Revolution?
Not so much before the Revolution, but during the Revolution you do.
Okay, so who was the first to actually abolish slavery?
Basically, it's Pennsylvania in 1780. Mm-hmm. Some people point to Vermont in 1777 because mm-hmm. their constitution outlawed slavery, but Vermont claimed they were a state in 1777, but nobody else recognized them as a state yet.
They were not Massachusetts, right, were they?
Yeah, New York and Connecticut. It's all contested territory.
They were the first quasi-state, the first proto-state.
Yeah, but basically it's Pennsylvania, and also there weren't really any slaves in Vermont for them to liberate. But so Pennsylvania did have thousands of slaves, and in 1780 they passed this gradual abolition law. And now, like most of these abolition laws from this period, it's very gradual. It doesn't actually free any slaves living at the time of its passage. It just frees their children, and only after their children reach the age of 28. So it basically makes their children into indentured servants to their current master until age 28. And then if they have a child, if a female indentured, black indentured servant has a child before she turns 28, that child then also owes labor to the master.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. This week we're speaking about abolition, and specifically about abolition before that famous abolitionist you've heard of, William Lloyd Garrison. It turns out there was a long history of this, and Nick Wood of Yale University is telling us all about it. After the break, we'll finish up our discussion with Nick Wood, so stick around. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's just about time to finish our discussion with Nicholas Wood, who is the Cassius Marcellus Clay Postdoctoral Associate in Early American History at Yale University, and who specializes in abolition and the history of slavery. I've been learning all kinds of interesting things about this very complex institution that spans several centuries in this nation. And along the way, discussing this with Wayne Winkler, my executive producer, it turns out that Jonesboro, Tennessee, which is quite near WETS, where we produce the show in Johnson City, Tennessee, Jonesboro, Tennessee was the site of the very first abolitionist newspaper in the United States. It was published starting in 1819 by a fellow named Elihu Embry, and it was first published under the title of the Manumission Intelligencer, later changed to The Emancipator. And Wayne and I both think that's very notable, that the very first abolitionist newspaper was published in a slave state. Unfortunately, Mr. Embry died after only a few months, and therefore the newspaper died with him. Turning back to Nick Wood, we were talking specifically about the issue of manumission, or the freeing of slaves, the voluntary freeing of slaves by slave owners, sometimes for money, sometimes for other reasons, and how it became quite an issue in many states. In fact, the states primarily in the North that started abolishing slavery around the time of the American Revolution or soon thereafter frequently did so gradually that it was going to take decades or sometimes even longer for everyone to be freed.
So even into the 1840s, you still have kind of black people in Pennsylvania, some of them living in this kind of quasi-slavery.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, on the one hand, it's such a moral outrage. You think anything other than immediate abolition is flawed.
Yeah.
That's a modern perspective, obviously.
Yeah.
At the time, this was an ingrained, important, certainly economically and socially important institution. So the idea of gradual abolition is probably, if you're going to have any kind of abolition, you're going to have some sort of gradual abolition.
Yeah.
But then on the other hand, I've often heard it said that some of these gradual abolition plans were so gradual that if you did the calculations, there would still have been slaves in like 1950.
Yeah, some of the proposals for them. Because, yeah, I mean, some of them say that yeah, it'll take as long to end slavery as slavery has existed so far. And so, as we said, slavery is around since 1619.
Right.
And this was somebody writing in the 1790s. So basically, I think it would be the 1970s is when he was expecting slavery to kind
heavens.
Of
yeah, that is
go
gradual.
Away. Yeah.
That is very
so fortunately,
gradual.
Gradualism did happen faster than some people envisioned it.
You know, I don't want to go on too much of a digression here, but I read a really interesting alternate history novel within the last year or so. I think it was called Underground Airways or something of that
okay,
sort.
Okay, don't know.
It posited a different timeline. Abraham Lincoln is assassinated during the interregnum, before he's actually inaugurated.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, the Civil War doesn't occur. There are no secessions. There's no Civil War. Slavery is perpetuated in the South, and it actually takes place in the present day where most Southern states have abolished slavery, but four states, I think, are still have slavery.
Huh.
And they describe it as a modern institution.
Yeah.
And the scenes where they're actually describing how it's going on, it really brings home to the reader what, at least it did to me, just how remarkable the institution of slavery is by modern standards, how clearly immoral it was and is, and wherever it might still exist. So I'd recommend that to listeners to look at. I think it's called Underground Airways or something of that sort. A very, very interesting treatment of this. My point in all of this is that slavery could have stuck around for a long time.
Yeah.
If things had worked out a little bit differently, even up into the 1970s, extraordinary as that is. Now let's go back to your area of expertise. I've often heard it said that some of the biggest anti-federalists were Quakers because I believe the expression they used was that the original Constitution was a pact with death. Is that, am I correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's
because of slavery.
That's actually William Lloyd Garrison kind of popularizes that phrase, a pact with the devil and a covenant with death.
Pact with the devil and a covenant with death.
Yeah,
that's
and,
a better statement of it. Okay.
Yeah, and he I can't remember the passage, but it's a biblical passage, obviously not in reference to slavery, but it's actually a recent book by Manisha Sinha called The Slave's Cause. Identifies, which is something I had known, that Garrison actually got that kind of idea from a black abolitionist, J.C. Pennington, a black abolitionist actually from Connecticut, who was the first to kind of use that term to describe the Constitution.
Because the original Constitution, though it never mentions the word slavery, very clearly in several different clauses, protects and perpetuates slavery.
Yeah, and there were some Quakers that used almost the same language. Thomas Roch from New Bedford, Massachusetts. He describes slavery as laying on a foundation, or he describes the Constitution. He says its foundation is slavery, and that is upon blood. So a lot of Quakers do express moral outrage at the time, especially with the fugitive slave provision, because they had previously celebrated, like Massachusetts had been refusing to kind of return runaways to South Carolina and places like that. So they are unhappy this kind of ends the sanctuary that slaves had in Massachusetts. But ultimately, most Quakers don't become anti-federalists. They do support ratification for a number of reasons. Some are just unrelated to slavery. They just think the Constitution will help kind of economically. But also, even with all the kind of pro-slavery compromises in the Constitution, it wasn't clear to them that it was actually worse in regard to slavery than the existing government, the Articles of Confederation, which is kind of what the Union had been governed by during the American Revolution, the War for Independence, because that was kind of in many ways just as bad. And kind of the Constitution is really complex. Some things kind of protected slavery, but then other things empowered the central government to do things that it couldn't have done before, including like end the Atlantic slave trade, which previously they hadn't really
After
had
20
any.
20 years, yeah.
Yeah, it's a compromise that's delayed until 1808. But previously under the Articles of Confederation, Congress had no power to regulate trade at all. So this is actually a grant of power while it's also a restriction of using that grant.
So maybe this new constitution was on balance better than what came before, or at least no worse.
Yeah, that's certainly what the Quakers thought.
Okay, so some of them vote to ratify. The constitution does get ratified, but opposition continues to grow.
Yeah.
And so can you tell us a little bit about that, and maybe even including the abolition of debate on the subject? That always fascinated me, mm-hmm. that the Congress didn't even want to have any petitions. But please tell about that.
Sure, yeah. The Quakers had been petitioning Congress during the American Revolution, so petitioning to the Continental Congress and the Confederation Congress in 1783, 1785, 86. And basically, Congress said, we're not going to do anything about this, and they just ignore the petitions. Sometimes they didn't even acknowledge that they'd received the petitions. It's right. only from private
and
correspondence.
And one of them who was filing them was Benjamin Franklin at the end there, wasn't he? He became president of the Pennsylvania.
So that'll be – that's in 1789. It's presented in 1790. Or I guess no, the one he did, but yeah, 1790. So this is the first federal Congress after ratification.
Right.
You had three petitions. From the Pennsylvania Abolition Society, of which Franklin is the honorary president, and then two groups of Quakers, the Philadelphia Yearly Meeting, the New York Yearly Meeting, and all calling for Congress to kind of step to the verge of their powers to suppress slavery and the slave trade particularly. And it's important to remember that at this point in February 1790, the Bill of Rights hadn't been ratified yet. So there is no formal First Amendment right to petition. Mm-hmm. So Congress could have just totally ignored it. And a lot of people wanted to do that, especially because they were busy with other matters, mm-hmm. Alexander Hamilton's financial plan.
There was a lot of stuff going on.
One. Yeah.
A lot of stuff going on.
And
you needed to build a capital city. There's that. Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
But yeah, all these Quakers travel up to New York City, which is the temporary capital at the mm-hmm. time. And there's a lot of fierce debate. The South Carolinians especially say, look, the Quakers, they refuse to support the American Revolution. They're the most unpatriotic people in America. They're basically British agents. And they have no right to petition about something that doesn't affect them. They freed their slaves, but they can't tell us what to do. And eventually, Congress passes a number of resolutions. Traditionally, historians have viewed this as kind of a real loss for the abolitionists. Mm-hmm. But if you look carefully,
what exactly was it? What we're describing before we talk about what the effect was.
So they have this special committee on the petitions, and they issue this report outlining congressional powers, and they begin by saying that by reiterating something that's clear in the Constitution that Congress has no power over slavery within the states. But they do emphasize that they have power to regulate the slave trade before fully abolishing it in 1808. And this is something that hadn't been clear under the Constitution. The Constitution just says you can't end the importation. They don't use the word slave trade. They say the importation or migration mm-hmm. of people basically until 1808, though they do say you can impose a duty of $10, so basically taxing the slave trade of
$10. You can tax the slave trade, right.
And now this report says not only can you do that $10 duty, but you could regulate some of the conditions of the Middle Passage, and you can prohibit Americans from being involved in the foreign slave trade or the foreign carrying trade to other places, meaning Congress could pass a law prohibiting people from Rhode Island, or prohibiting anybody, but it's Rhode Islanders who are actually the biggest slave traders at the time.
Right.
And the Rhode Islanders were going to Africa, buying slaves there, and then bringing them not back into the U.S. largely, but selling them to the West Indies, especially the Spanish territories, which had just opened up
molasses
the slave trade.
Molasses to rum to slaves.
Yeah. So basically they say that Congress does have the power to prohibit the participation in the carrying trade to foreign nations. They can prohibit people from going to Africa, buying slaves, and then selling them to other countries like the British West Indies or the Spanish possessions in the West Indies. And that, nothing in the Constitution had alluded to that. So this is actually a kind of a grant of power. And Southerners try to get rid of this provision, but it's still, and they do amend the committee report, but that provision is still present in this final committee report. And it takes a while before Congress actually implements that power, but they do in 1794. They pass the Foreign Slave Trade Act and ban people. It's mostly New Englanders, especially Rhode Island, that had been kind of involved in this carrying trade to foreign countries. But after 1794, that's illegal, and they revise the law. They strengthen it in 1800. And so they do really kind of limit the slave trade as much as they constitutionally can before 1808, when they fully abolish it.
And we keep talking about the slave trade as a special case. That was considered kind of the worst part
Yeah.
of slavery, wasn't it? Because of those slave ships and what happened on them.
Yeah, and it's tearing apart families, horrible
right.
conditions, lots of death. I mean, the tragic thing is that the Atlantic slave trade, as it kind of dies down to America, we have at the same time the simultaneous growth of the domestic slave trade within the U.S.
We did an entire episode on what's called the slave trail of tears.
Yeah.
The internal migration that happened on top of that. Another fascinating and tragic subject.
Yeah.
Okay, but you actually have Congress then, because of all of this pressure from the abolitionists on the one side
yep.
and the slave owners on the other. They get to the point where they actually refuse to accept these petitions anymore.
Yeah, so that's in the 1830s. They pass what's known as the gag rule,
yeah.
which basically says that any petition about slavery will simply be tabled. And what that means, it'll be put on a table. Anybody who wants to can go read it, but it's just understood that they're not going to read it out loud to Congress. They're not going to consider it. They're not certainly not going to take any action on it. It's just a way to stifle debate. Now, historians have shown that in some ways this kind of backfires ultimately, because initially the people submitting anti-slavery petitions are this minority of white Americans who are abolitionists. But the abolitionists are able to really spin this, get some really good PR, saying, look, the slave power, as they call the Southerners,
yeah.
they are oppressing not only slaves, but stifling the rights of white Northerners to have free discussion.
Yeah.
And it's oppressing white people, too. And so then you have what's kind of known as the rise of political anti-slavery. It's people that are inspired by a combination of moral sentiment and concern for enslaved black people, but also about how Southerners are infringing on their own rights as white Northerners.
Well, you can see this even in the modern day. You'll see a relatively unpopular political cause. We'll have protests,
mm-hmm.
and then the police will crack
yeah.
down on them.
Overreact,
and a lot of people will say, well, wait a second. They have the right to protest. They have the right of free speech, and it does backfire politically.
Yep.
In fact, I think that's, to some extent, part of the reason for the success of the later civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of white Northerners who might not have been particularly concerned about what was going on in Selma certainly didn't like seeing the fire hoses and the dogs
yeah.
and all the rest of it. And that can really galvanize people. So that had happened earlier in our
yeah.
history as well. Well, that actually brings us up then to the Garrison period
yeah.
when things changed. And so to some extent to the end of your focus. Mm-hmm. But we're so happy that you could come to Montpelier and share this with us mm-hmm. tomorrow. And so you're going to be talking tomorrow to whom? To middle school teachers and high school teachers?
Yeah, middle school and high school teachers.
Uh-huh.
Whole weekend
so
about
basically
slavery
it's a whole room full of people like your wife.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
my wife had done a few of these seminars in the past when she lived here in Virginia.
Oh, I see. So you yeah. that okay? Well, I'm sure. So you know all about these seminars.
Yep.
Well, then we'll just plug that, especially if you live nearby, especially if you're anywhere near Montpelier, Charlottesville, Virginia, especially if you're a teacher. We have these seminars all the time, all throughout the year. We have some that are specifically designed for teachers, some that are specifically designed for other groups, such as law enforcement. Focus would be a bit different there, obviously.
I would imagine.
But they're there, and we bring in wonderful people like Nick, who have obviously huge amounts of knowledge to share. So thank you for coming in and sharing that with the people here at Montpelier and with the people on this show. And what's your wife's name again?
Allison Wood.
Yep. Okay, Allison. He's on the show, so now you can share this with his mom and with your mom, and everybody can listen in.
Yep. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Nick.
And that's our show. Thanks very much to Nicholas Wood of Yale University for telling us all about the history of early abolition in the United States. And thanks also to Nick's wife, Allison, whom I had the pleasure of meeting right after I did this interview at Montpelier, as she walked Nick and her beautiful little baby all around the beautiful grounds of Montpelier. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our music is by the fifes and drums of Colonial Williamsburg. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.